Hello, people of the internet. How's it going today? How you doing? I'm Billy Bones, and this is A Walk Through the Mind, the moment where we can sit down, hang out, chit-chat, discuss a handful of ideas that have been bouncing around inside my head, and see if we can't take those ideas for ourselves and go out and get the conversation started with friends, family, the people we meet on the street, or maybe we just get those gears turning within our own head and see where it takes us. So a little bit more than a year ago, as far as mushrooms go, all I knew about them is you went to the grocery store and you either bought the white ones or the brown ones, the criminies, or the portobellos. That's all I knew about mushrooms. Now, I'm not saying I'm a mushroom wizard now, and it's definitely a difficult thing when you hit the news. You type in your favorite search engine, you hit the news button on mushrooms, and all that comes up is psychedelics. Now, I'm sure there's some healthy prospects to psychedelic mushrooms, but not everybody wants to eat psychedelic mushrooms with their steak or on their burger, maybe just as a simple side dish, mixing it in with their spaghetti sauce or whatever comes to mind. There's a lot more to just kind of mushrooms than putting them on food. Again, they're delicious. We've got some healthy ideas to go looking after as far as the lion's mane goes, as we discussed last episode, with helps with dementia and all sorts of other things. Healthy source of antioxidants. It's something they definitely advertise with just your regular buttons at the grocery store. Good source of vitamin D, something that helps with healing with the skin. At least as far as I recall, vitamin D is for the skin. Vitamin B seems to be plentiful in oyster mushrooms, good for mental conduciveness. But these crazy little things that we think of as plants aren't really plants. They have their own little kingdom sitting somewhere conveniently between plants and animals. They're the midway point that breaks things down. Think about how everything kind of interacts from dust to dust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We all go down. When trees come down in the forest, we think they just kind of lay there and they kind of break down. Mushrooms are there to break down trees, make them so that they're a little bit more edible for the bugs that come through, and the bugs feed the plants. But underneath the ground, the mushroom, the thing that we see, the thing that we eat, is merely just the fruit of the mushroom. Underneath the ground, or within that rotting tree, is the mycelium, little individual strands that connect back and forth throughout everything, creating a super web. You can't really see it unless you start breaking everything apart, and when you break everything apart, it really doesn't look like much. You can't see much of it because it's all single cells stacked one on top of the other as they break things down and grow longer and longer and interconnect in a three-dimensional lattice pattern. And within that pattern, they help break down nutrients and whatnot. They help with trees. Trees are natural carbon sequestering devices. We don't need giant fans to suck air out of the air, carbon out of the air at least, and then put it into concrete blocks and store it underground forever. Trees inhale carbon dioxide through their leaves and through their branches. They put some of it within the bark and the branches and the leaves and put it all to use, but the majority of it is stored underground. And there, the mushrooms are able, the mycelium is able to take that and help turn it into something else, some sort of acid deal. I didn't clip that clip because it was a little bit too involved and not direct enough. Now I feel I should have. But it breaks down and it helps create the dirt that is underneath the trees, breaking down the nutrients, breaking down rocks, chiseling away at them, so that way the tree can get its own vitamins and minerals. But again, when things break down and die, they help break those things down even more as well, giving more nutrients and repurposing things. There's an individual named Paul Stamets who's been really up on everything that is mushrooms. These weird little things that are growing throughout the world. And I believe there's over So 750,000 or 6.5 million. I know that's a wide swath, but it's one of those two numbers. Designates the number of different mushroom species out there. And really only a handful, and I think that number is right around 20,000, produce mushrooms. All the rest of them are just mycelium that kind of interact and do everything, but they don't put off the fruit of mushrooms. And not all mushrooms are edible. There's a lot of mushrooms that, again, are psychedelic. If you look those up, they might be considered poisonous. There's other ones that are legitimately poisonous that will make you very sick if you eat them and give you no reality enhancement. And then there's plenty of other ones that are delicious and edible and provide some sort of health benefit. Thinking about the interconnected web underneath the ground of the mycelium and how it looks, how it's displayed within the videos that are available in today's vast quantity of show notes. Check out the TED Talk or the Netflix documentary. But it's an interconnection, almost like the neurons within your brain, how they move nutrients around, how they interconnect and talk amongst each other. But thinking about that lion's mane, when you tear it apart, because it just tears apart. You don't cut it like you would a button, criminy, or a portobello. It tears apart, and you can cut it, depending on what shape you want to make. But when you tear it, kind of looks like a cross-section of a brain when you look at some of those MRI pictures on some of the television shows that go on top to bottom or side to side. Kind of resembles the brain. Kind of funny to think that the lion's mane might even offer mental benefits. But that's not the mycelium. That's the fruiting part. Mycelium is the one that does all the heavy lifting, that breaks things down. And Mr. Paul Stamets has even figured out that it's not just for trees anymore.
Battelle Laboratories and I joined up in Bellingham, Washington. There were four piles saturated with diesel and other petroleum waste. One was a control pile. One pile was treated with enzymes. One pile was treated with bacteria. And our pile, we inoculated with mushroom mycelium. The mycelium absorbs the oil. The mycelium is producing enzymes, peroxidases, that break carbon-hydrogen bonds. These are the same bonds that hold hydrocarbons together. So the mycelium becomes saturated with the oil, and then when we returned 6 weeks later, all the tarps were removed, all the other piles were dead, dark, and stinky. We came back to our pile, it was covered with hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms, and the color changed to a light form. The enzymes remanufactured the hydrocarbons into carbohydrates, fungal sugars. Some of these mushrooms are very happy mushrooms, they're very large. They're showing how much nutrition that they could have obtained. But something else happened, it was an epiphany in my life. They sporulated, the spores attract insects, the insects laid eggs, eggs became larvae, birds then came bringing in seeds, and our pile became an oasis of life. Whereas the other three piles were dead, dark, and stinky, and the PAHs, the aromatic hydrocarbons, went from 10,000 parts per million to less than 200 in 8 weeks. The last image we don't have, the entire pile was a green berm of life. These are gateway species, vanguard species that open the door for other biological communities.
Now, I don't know how well those oyster mushrooms that he threw on the hydrocarbon pile would necessarily taste. Might have a funky flavor to them, seeing as the material that they brought in would definitely shape and form the fungal sugars that they're able to use and transform into a fruiting body. But nonetheless, the pollution numbers, as you heard, drastically reduced over 8 weeks of the mycelium soaking up and breaking down the hydrocarbons. And then the bonus benefit of the spores bringing in bugs and birds bring seeds and life begins anew. And now this maybe still slightly toxic, however you want to rate it, significantly less toxic than it started, but a much better starting point of renewal, that point to come back and give us something new, and maybe the plants and whatnot are able to break things down just a little bit further. But who says we have to stick to merely just hydrocarbons for cleaning stuff up?
So I invented burlap sacks, bunker spawn, and putting the mycelium using storm-blown debris. You can take these burlap sacks and put them downstream from a farm that's producing E. coli or other waste, or a factory with chemical toxins, and it leads to habitat restoration.
So not only can we take hydrocarbons, we can even look at other things that are kind of detrimental to the environment. pathogens and things like that, that we don't want getting into the rivers and the streams and messing everything else up. And it's not to say that the mushrooms are a cure-all and a fix-all. I think we need to be active in our ways of making sure we maintain things the cleanest that we can. But again, in that sense of being able to break things down, clean things up, create barriers, putting in burlap sacks for him, or there's other ways that have been listed that you just take bales of hay, bales of straw, and inoculate those with the mycelium. Because it's not that you just plant seeds, it's the spores kind of do their own little thing, and they need a chance to grow. But once they start growing, once they're doing their thing and you're able to expand that process, why not create little spots where plants and whatnot are able to grow and achieve something? But to continue on the path of the health benefits, when we look at, again, just that vitamin D and vitamin B and whatever proteins and simple carbohydrates that come with that, there's other mushrooms, such as the agaricon mushroom that Paul Stamets is rather fascinated about and seems to be a very difficult mushroom to come upon.
I've been involved with the U.S. Defense Department BioShield program. We submitted over 300 samples of mushrooms that we boiled in hot water and mycelium, harvesting these extracellular metabolites. And a few years ago, we received these results. We have three different strains of agaricon mushrooms that were highly active against pox viruses. Dr. Earl Kern, who's a smallpox expert of the U.S. Defense Department, states that any compounds that have a selectivity index of two or more are active, 10 or greater are considered to be very active. Our mushroom strains were in the highly active range. There's a vetted press release that you can read that's vetted by DOD if you Google Stamets and smallpox, or you can go to npr.org and listen to a live interview. So encouraged by this, naturally, we went to flu viruses. And so for the first time, I'm showing this. We have three different strains of agaricon mushrooms, highly active against flu viruses. Here's the selectivity index numbers. Against pox, you saw 10s and 20s. Now, against flu viruses, compared to the ribavirin controls, we are having extraordinarily high activity. And we're using a natural extract within the same dosage window as a pure pharmaceutical. We tried against flu A viruses, H1N1, H3N2, as well as flu B viruses. So then we tried a blend, and then a blend combination, we tried it against H5N1, and we got greater than 1,000.
So helping against pox viruses and the flu virus. Now granted, that's a specific old growth forest mushroom that's, again, very difficult to find, but what's to say properties don't exist between a handful of other mushrooms? Or this mushroom that he's talking about back in 2008, he did get a chance to copy the spores so he can recreate this mushroom in several different spots as long as the conditions are correct for it to grow. But a natural plant-style medicine against a couple different things, and again, breaking down the particulars and throwing it through scientific vials and beakers to hyper-focus it, but a helpful thing, something that's not excessively processed within a lab just to get it into a pill form or into a liquid vaccine. But we won't stop there with just the health benefits. We can even go after the little pests that kind of eat away at our homes.
I became interested in entomopathogenic fungi, fungi that kill insects. Our house is being destroyed by carpenter ants. So I went to the EPA homepage, and they were recommending studies with metarhizium species of a group of fungi that kill carpenter ants, as well as termites. I did something that nobody else had done. I actually chased the mycelium when it stopped producing spores. These are spores. This is no spores. I was able to morph the culture into a non-sporulating form. And so the industry has spent over $100 million specifically on bait stations to prevent termites from eating your house. But the insects aren't stupid. They would avoid the spores when they came close. And so I morphed the cultures into a non-sporulating form. And I got my daughter's Barbie doll dish. I put it right with a bunch of carpenter ants were making debris fields every day in my house. And the ants were attracted to the mycelium because there's no spore. They gave it to the queen. 1 week later, I had no sawdust piles whatsoever. And then a delicate dance between dinner and death. The mycelium is consumed by the ants. They become mummified, and boing, a mushroom pops out of their head.
So again, this piece was from the TED Talk, but if you look at the Netflix documentary Fantastic Fungi, they go into just a little bit more detail about these ants and what's going on. And as soon as the ant kind of brushes up against the spores, there's guards that refuse to let the ants in, or the termites. And so, however he did his scientific laboratory stuff, he made it so that way the spores were able to get to the ants and then go in, infect the ants, and prevent them from continuing to eat his house.
Now, after sporulation, the spores repel, so the house is no longer suitable for invasion. So you have a near-permanent solution for reinvasion of termites. And so my house came down. I received my first patent against carpenter ants, termites, and fire ants. Then we tried extracts, and lo and behold, we can steer insects to different directions. This has huge implications. I then received my second patent, and this is a big one. It's been called an Alexander Graham Bell patent, because it covers over 200,000 species. This is the most disruptive technology I've been told by executives of the pesticide industry that they have ever witnessed.
So we can stop carpenter ants and termites with mushrooms, little myceliums going on. Now, maybe we're not able to eat those, but again, something a little on the revolutionary side, something that we would have never kind of considered. I thought all we had to use was crude oil-based products to spray down our house and set it on fire, and that kills all the ants. Luckily, we got something else available to us. And through his projects of not genetic engineering, but selective breeding to acquire such strains of mushrooms, he's able to create these fantastic things. But we're, again, not going to stop there. There's also speculation that's kind of died off, and I wonder if big oil has anything to do about it. But there's a novel concept, novel name, called mycodiesel, applied to the volatile organic products made by fungi that have fuel potential. The latest discovery is that of an endophytic hypoxanol nodulosporium species, or one that lives within a plant that makes the compound cinnol, along with a number of other cyclohexanes, colorless flammable liquids found in petroleum, crude oil, and volcanic gases, and compounds with enormous fuel potential. Paul Stamets, back in 2008, wanted to call this ecanol, a play on words of eco-friendly and ethanol. Again, instead of ethanol being formed from corn, which is nice and easy to grow, and then goes through whatever process to create ethanol, which is very detrimental to plastics, and so it seems not really healthy for your car, but definitely maintains some of the combustion power of gasoline, making it a little bit cheaper, making the corn producers get just a little bit more money so it doesn't all go to complete waste. But there's plenty of potential out there in things that we're able to do with mushrooms. Again, not just eating some delicious meat alternative, but we can even go so far as to replace another crude oil project, such as styrofoam packaging. One of the things that kind of really grinds my gears as far as petroleum and recyclables go. Styrofoam is very recyclable. It's made up of little tiny pellets. But when you want to break it down, you have to use a special chemical compound to break it down. And it's not cost efficient. The recycling game doesn't like to spend money. They want their government handout monies to make things happen. But there's a company out there, not endorsed, not endorsing this podcast or me or anything, but mushroompackaging.com. Those people out there have figured out how to specially form and shape the mycelium of mushrooms, that interlocking web. However they go about it, they're able to form it around whatever design that you need. And again, instead of using those terrible packing peanuts or whatever slabs of styrofoam we get our TVs packed in or computers or whatever we're getting shipped, and then we're not allowed to recycle that styrofoam. No, we have to throw it into the landfill, and who knows what happens there. No, this stuff, this mushroom packaging, you just throw it out in your backyard. You throw it in your compost pile. You throw it in your compost bin. And even if you do decide to throw it in the trash, it will break down naturally. So again, it's all just a bit more than your button mushroom that you found at the local grocery store. There's a lot more to them. There's a lot more research. A lot more paths that we can go down. Again, not just grilling them up or boiling them into our soups, more than just a simple shiitake as our exorbitant mushroom. Go check out your farmer's markets. Go see if there's a local mushroom person growing out there. Maybe do some YouTube and figuring out how to grow your own mushrooms at home. The legal kind, not the funny kind. Maybe some other day we'll talk about the funny kind, but today, health benefits. Not only for the person, not only for the individual, but for the group of us. And what these fantastic little things can do in the greater scheme of things. And at some level, only our imagination is our limit. And we'll be able to figure out where we're going. To the stars. Or from the stars. That's the other thing I forgot. The spores of mushrooms can survive the vacuum of outer space. Which is kind of how they appeared here. Or at least theorized. Showing up on an asteroid. Crash landing. And populating from there. But I'm not from outer space. I'm not even from a spore. But I might be part mushroom. Who knows? My name is Billy Bones. B-I-L-L-Y-B-O-N, the number 3-S. You find me on Twitter, at least for now. We'll see how that's going, Mr. Elon Musk. At Billy Bones. You find me on the Fediverse, the Mastodon. At Billy Bones, at noagendasocial.com. Go there, or either of those places. You go there, you boost the tweet, retweet the tweet. When I post the show, maybe I said something funny or witty. Maybe I have some post that's worth reading. Or maybe you just need to find a reason to block me. And that's how you find me. One of those two names. But if you're not looking to block me, if you're looking to dig into further information, you can go to the website. Got one of those. Again, that's billybones.com. That's spelt with the number 3 instead of an E. And there you can find show notes. Quite the collection today. Just to get you started down the path of these things called mushrooms. But there's also links to previous episodes. There's links to the SoundCloud. There's links to email if you need to run a longer diatribe than a mere 140 characters. There's a link for Tabletop Woodworks. That's my personal business if you need some extra value for value. And there's that value for value button. If you found value out of this podcast, be it a solo, single episode, or the entire catalog, fantastic. The first thing that I ask that you do is you give this show a share. Maybe someone else finds a talking point, finds a set of gears that gets turning in their head, and they go off and they find something they didn't know they were interested in thinking about or learning. But if you felt that this show was worth a monetary value, somewhere between a cup of coffee, if you think I've earned one of those, maybe you want to buy me a pizza, you send that and dollars through PayPal. You can go to billybones.com. You scroll all the way down, click that value for value button. It'll take you to PayPal. Chip in, you donate, you support the show, a number that you feel is appropriate. Again, cup of coffee, piece of pizza, maybe an island in the Bahamas. If you have that much money, if you think that this show is worth that much. And we have today's executive producer, at least the first of many today, of Lady Get Over It, sending in her monthly $10 donation. Thank you very much for helping me keep these bills paid. Thank you for keeping the lights on, the mics humming, the music rolling. But if you don't believe in the Federal Reserve Freedom Unit, otherwise known as the U.S. dollar, and you want to try some new form of currency, then you're using one of those new podcast apps, one of the ones that support Podcasting 2.0. You can send in Satoshis, little teeny tiny bits of Bitcoin that all add up. And we'll start off with a boostagram from Bully Steed, sending in 11,727 Satoshis, commenting on a fender bender from the May 1st episode. She says, I received good advice about purchasing a pre-owned auto with stacks of documentation from owner selling. Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you for clarifying or verifying or however we want to read that out. And then we have one from Pocket Parlay, sending in 4,750 Satoshis, commenting on the previous episode, Cultivated Meats. Living free in Tennessee allowed us to process meat birds for the first time this year. That was an interesting experience. The value of knowing where your meat comes from is huge. Great episode. It's going to be a hard pass on tumor meat for me, though. Thank you, Pocket Parlay. You check him out at lighttickle.com. Fantastic podcast over there. Give that a listen. Expand your mind on the East and the West Coast kind of views. But thank you, everybody else, for listening. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you found something worthwhile, something of continuing the conversation, something again to get those gears turning. But I love you guys, and I'll talk to you next week.